Okay, so it's my pleasure to welcome our second speaker on the art safari, Fiona Partington, who, people always say this, but I really mean it, probably needs no introduction to many of you. She's someone whose work is well known to Christchurch audiences. She shows at Jonathan Smart Gallery across town regularly. She was recently seen in the Snare exhibition in what used to be the Robert McDougall Art Gallery. And she was in the opening show for the Christchurch Art Gallery almost 7 years ago. So her work's seen here. It's also seen as far afield as the spectacular Museum Quiberon Lee in Paris. And she's extremely, I think probably one of the best represented artists in brought to light. And there's a very good reason for that, which is that the very title of the show comes directly from this suite of photographs by Fiona, which the translation of which is to bring to light, to claim again, which seemed to us to be a phrase that summed up both the pleasures and the challenges for anyone sort of opening the box and looking into a collection. So we were delighted that Fiona sort of gave the blessing to the use of that phrase in the show. And Fiona's work is also seen up the arcade. We'll head along there shortly. And if you happen to be on Worcester Boulevard, but especially on Worcester Boulevard at dusk or in the evening, do make sure you see a work called The Prow of the Charlotte Jane, which is glowing on our big illuminated billboard out there. So welcome, Fiona.
Thank you. Thanks for that great introduction. Did you see my brother's show downstairs?
Yes.
Yeah. 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 So he's the younger man. I'm a big fan of his, so it's really cool to be in this space now with him. Now, I was really it was really cool to listen to Terry talk a bit earlier, and he said that my Naitahumata is Hinekino Tahoro, which is evil woman Tahoro. She did some pretty bad things, actually. So, but anyway, it's quite a good family to be related to. My great-grandmother, Annie Bradshaw, is Tino Regan's great-aunt. So when I got old enough to work out who our Naitahu family was, I thought, fantastic. They're important. That'll help. But for me, my dad was born in the Bluff with a Cameron family. My brother and I, our stepfather is a Partington. So we're the Camerons from Bluff and the big mountains around the field and the Bluff. It's the Cameron Mountains. So that's something I'm really excited and proud about. Really, and also like Terry was saying, really interesting family. Irish whaler married Hinekino to stop her from being hung because she just killed one of her daughters to her chief Te Ika, who lived in around Kaiapoi. So I didn't understand why she was so called Hinekino. She tied the child's legs and hands with flax and weighted her down with stones and threw her in. The reason she survived was, what's the name of the Southland Diaries? Who were they by? I've just forgotten. One of the early Europeans that came through, he had diaries and the sad stories in there. But because there was no rule of law in Moiraki at the time, they couldn't hang her because it would set a precedent, an unlawful precedent. So her husband-to-be, the whaler, who was from County Cork, who was before that from New South Wales, he'd been deported from Cork and he had been in hard labour over there for 12 years and then got pardoned. So they whipped off to Wellington and got married. And he turned out to be her second of three husbands. But that's where my side of the family came from. And then the Camerons too, they were from the Highlands of Scotland and came down and opened up. The mayor of Matara was Cameron. The Matara Kilties was started by one of my great uncles. They're all great pipers. Then they married into the Bradshaw family down in Bluff. So my great uncle, he had the Fresh Oyster Company, you know, the black and white, the blue and white tins, check tins. That was the family oyster factory, but he went crazy in the last week before he died and signed it all off to the public trust, so my dad didn't get the money. So the family were pretty upset about that.
especially my dad.
But he actually, we didn't grow up with him. He was a ballroom, a professional ballroom dancer in Britain most of my childhood. He came back in my 20s and he died. Excuse me. So he is an Italian second wife who looked exactly like my mother, which is very strange. And so he was a champion ballroom dancer. And the family, the Camerons and family down there, they still always say they're Italians, because they thought it meant a lot more at the time. And I've got photographs of my great grandmother, guardian, Annie Bradshaw, sitting on a camel in front of the Eiffel Tower. So she also had a zoo down there, and most amazing clothes. Yeah, she spent a lot of money, which she's probably passed that on to my daughter, Aqua. Because I grew up with a step family who were actually quite racist, nobody bothered to tell us till we were in our 20s. Because we'd forgotten, because we're so little we couldn't remember our proper dad. So that's one of the reasons I kind of belatedly started working with Ngāi Tahu Tāmu. Also, just out of respect for the things, I just didn't think I was up to it until I got to after I was 40. And then I decided to try to address it or take it on, because it is like a bit of a struggle. It's like Jacob struggling with the angel. When you come to beautiful Tāmu like this, and ever since I was little, my grandmother used to take me to the Auckland Museum, and my brother and I loved the Pōnāmu best of all. These little guys are all sitting out the back because they're not considered to be particularly good examples of paytaking. And I think I was kind of a bit confused initially when I saw what Dick Frizzell was doing with paytaking, and I kind of understood the traction and I understood the argument, but I understood what Air New Zealand hotikis looked like. But I still didn't understand, and I couldn't see in society where the truthfulness of the actual thing or the in itself of the object. I mean, it can mean a lot of different things over different generations and time frames. For instance, Michael Parikōwhai won't work with traditional imagery because he thinks that it exoticizes it. Well, in his time frame and in his relation, for us of his work, which is the connection we have with objects, it probably does. But there's something else apart from that. There is much more than that, and preceding aesthetic and social engagement with Tāmu is another reality, which is the one that that doesn't end, and which will proceed into our their future, the future where I won't be. And so what I've done is I've made these works for the people in the future, and in a future where I'm not going to be, I won't exist. And that's one of the good things about being an artist. And one of the things is, now I'm getting old, I'm more and more acutely aware of, because I have a primary relationship with objects as a photographer, because it's true that as a photographer you have to take a picture of something, but people always forget too that when we speak we have to be speaking of something, and when we think we're thinking of something. So though we have, but that kind of thing, that situatedness of photography has been quite hard for people to enjoy or value. Pōnāmu is green, and I'm not a colour photographer. Well, I am now, but I wasn't until reasonably recently. And I, first of all, didn't want to photograph Pōnāmu because I think they're very powerful, very beautiful, and it's also very green. And then I realised the important things about them. Their qualities, the secondary characteristics of sensation and colour and lustre and weight, and those are all important things, but there is a kind of spiritual quality or a thingness which doesn't necessarily need to be represented by colour. And so what I did, rather than photograph them as the object and nothing but the object, I let the work be more interpretive in order that people could step in imaginatively and provide and have a position provided for them to stand and make contact with whatever it was or is that are each of these Pounamu taonga. I mean, they are like, when I was first test driving my little contact prints, I was teaching at the time at Eden on other artists, and I give them to woman artists, and they go, oh, look, they look like little babies. Ooh, they're so cute. I want to touch them. But that is probably one aspect of them these days, you know, like the fetus or, I mean, there's many things you could say about like what how pagic you are and aren't. And there's no way you can really speak about them for too long without them just becoming indistinguishable in the sense that they have the potential to be and have been so many things. So I just concentrated on portraits of each of them. I also used this really old-fashioned soft focus filters that were used on the glass filters you put over your enlarge on your handprint. And they were used to photograph movie stars like Marilyn Monroe, and earlier than that usually, so they had that beautiful kind of haze around them. And I liked that as an effect because it released the work from what photography does, which is it has a very factual engagement and register. And it kind of turns the volume down on that, so you can start thinking about other things and look at the kind of anthropomorphic quality, look at the different kind of energy and dynamic that's created in the sculpture of the figures. The eyes sometimes will, some of them you can see them both at the same time, but sometimes they reverse out. And so you kind of get a negative effect, and they kind of move in and out of the shadow. So, and I've used a background which is from my grandmother's old opera cape, so I think it belonged to her mother. And it's kind of a faux fur, so it's kind of got this nice, I don't know, kind of human kind of thing that we all have a relationship with in some kind of past world. But it's also the idea of, you know, sitting nicely on a cloak or sitting respectfully in a position where you can take yourself imaginatively to it. And some of them were really rudimentary. Because one of the things that dawned on me while I was looking at them was not all Paytiki are going to be made out of the best stone. And not, and then I thought, well, actually not all Māori's going to be good greenstone carvers. So there's some that are quite, not rude, but you know, they've got this, some of them look like modern art. I've got one I photographed recently with my friend Koozie. So you get the idea that it's good because it kind of unpicks things, so you can actually sensibly look at Haitiki and think about how they really were used and how would you get one? You know, would you, you know, go and steal one off somebody, or would you get your mate to carve one for you if you really wanted one, or did you just wait for the one to come down through the family to you? And you can see many of these have actually been around for a heck of a long time because of the drilled out suspension, the rubbed out suspension holes. There's some of them have two or even three, like there's three on this one, and maybe a fourth one just started here, don't know. So I think that's basically what I wanted to say to you about Paytiki. I noticed we've got some of the stamps from now, which is good. It's like who are you and back in cognizance, you know. We now have them not in tea towels, but you know, I see them in a lot of jewellery now, and I think that's great because it just makes us engage more with the actual our avian history, and our cultural history. That's all I think. Is that all right? Is that enough? Anybody got anything they want to ask me?
Fiona, would you like to go up the corridor?
Yeah, sure. If you want to do that now, but have I not, have I used up a lot of time? Or not enough?
No, you're going well, I think.
Do you want to move
up? It's a well-oiled machine, this whole public program.
Okay, all right, we better go then. Now, this is something I've just done quite recently in the building I'm This is my house, and the gallery. And the museum have got amazing staff who are really interesting, helpful, enthusiastic and kind of passionate curators. And I rang up and organised to make a time to come and talk to curators because there's a few things I knew that were in the collections because I've already photographed a lot of Hooea and different birds, almost all the kakapo. And Natalie Caden here turned out to be this incredible well of information, and she'd say, "Oh my goodness, have you heard about this?" And she said, "Oh, this is this boat, glass boat." And I'm going, "Oh, boats, I hate boats, I want to photograph a boat." And I was thinking, colonial, it just can't just be the Hooea and the Heiteke. Let's have a look at the boats. And she said, "Oh, it's a glass one." And I thought, wow, that would be great, because glass is really great to photograph. And so she got it out, and it's about this big, big on a lovely little cradle that looked like kind of a lot of toast racks, old-fashioned silver toast racks. And it was made, I've got the information here, by a guy called John William Lester Rowe, and he lived from 1921 to 2009. Before the Second World War, he worked for Claude Neon and learned to blow glass. And then he went to the war and he served in Egypt, north of Italy. And after the war finished, he went to Italy to the Venetian Glassworks and learned to do this type of thing. That kind of really intricate looping of like fine sticks of glass. I remember when I was a kid, used to be able to get Easter eggs that style too, but made out of coloured icing. Yeah, they were great. So I get hungry every time I look at that because I just think of the Easter eggs. Anyway, he was amazing. So he came back to New Zealand and worked for Claude Neon until he retired, and he did this type of thing out in the shed out the back. Now, what made it even more interesting is when Natalie gleefully told me that there's a time capsule inside the ship, okay, and you'll never be able to read what he's written in there. It's all the information about how many hours it took and everything like that. He's written it all down, rolled it up, put it in a glass tube in the middle of the boat. There was a boat before this that got stolen. It went on, it was a Canterbury anniversary celebrations, first ship was, and it was vanished, the presumed stolen, and nobody's seen it since, so if you know anybody that's got one of those, it's stolen. And also what else he did that was very cool, working the shed out the back, he made a model of a plane with wings 4 feet wide. It had been a particular plane that had done the London to New Zealand race, but a cat jumped on it and smashed it. So here we have this. The other thing is, it's said to be the Charlotte Jane, but there is one of the grandchildren think it's the Randolph, but everybody's basically saying it's the Charlotte Jane. Though I think, for those that know more about ships than I think it's the wrong size here and a bit heavy, kind of a bit too tubby. But he went into the museum and looked through the glass at the little cut and models of the ships and took measurements and worked like that. So it's just fantastic Kiwi ingenuity. And I mean, if you have a look, even though it's a bit hard to see initially, because there's so much glittering reflective light, there's these beautiful big anchors. They're just absolutely lovely. I mean, the shape of the objects that are, you know, the elements inside this object are just beautiful. And the little lady on the front, she's got nipples in her glass. And she's got this lovely hair that kind of makes her look like a Medusa. So it was a very enthusiastic object, and being around it, you could just see the love and attention the guy had lavished on this object, and the amount of fun he must have had making it. And to me, any people that create anything or have any, it doesn't have to be physical, you know, it's like looking after a child, or you're really gleeful about how well you're doing, and what a great thing it is. Well, they are, and it's the same thing here. It's just it's a beautiful object. It's photographed on black velvet because, and as you can see, it isn't something to easily situate in a space. But also, you'll notice that in a lot of my work, I situate them in kind of an indistinguishable kind of space because then it allows the object itself to be contemplated in a way that allows the reference when you make is more directly the type that I'd like you to be making, which is about the thing and your relationship with it, rather than the thing in its, you know, in its situatedness, which I suppose for an object like this, I mean, there is no, you know, way of really placing it anywhere. Oh, and it's because they've stopped making my favourite photographic film, like that I've made with Haiti. This is done where I've managed to get online some really great Zeiss lenses, you know, manual ones that you have to operate and focus yourself in the right time and then you throw it at somebody and kill them. It's so heavy. And I've been using it with a digital camera, and the billboard on the outside of the building, the photograph is made with a huge big digital negative, like you can print it out on inkjet with transparency, these enormous big, you can make like a negative that size, and all you've got to do is actually then contact print it. So you just slap it onto the pieces in the darkroom and under the red lights. You can slap the negative right on top of the piece of paper, put a piece of glass on, and expose it like you normally would with an enlarger, and you've got this photograph. So that's kind of some of the changes that I've made more recently. This Fuji film, though, they bought a lot of Polaroid products that were involved in the medical imaging. They haven't bought that particular type of film, even though there's been people all over the world thinking about buying it up and setting up boutiques. So that's why my new work looks like this and doesn't look like the ones around the corner anymore. That's about it, really.
Thank you very much, Gianna. And it, just as we're sitting in front of this work, it's probably worth noting there are around 30 new acquisitions in the show, and Fiona's is the newest of those new acquisitions. And at least on paper or on the computer-aided designs, a whole lot of the show was finalised. Almost everything about the show was finalised, and we saw an image of this work, and the email went out to all the people who were involved in thinking about buying works, and the answers came in, which just went sort of yes, exclamation mark, yes, exclamation mark, yes, exclamation mark. It's just a work that seems to speak so terrifically to so many things about where we are and where we're going and all of those things.
Oh, I was just totally lucky. It surprised me when I saw it on the outside of the billboard. I think I put it down to an good liaison with amazing curators at Canterbury. That's the difference for artists, if you've got good relations like that in here. That's what it's all about.
Cool. Okay, all right, chapter three.
There's a question,
sorry.
Turn on. Interested in this because I'm interested in how you lit it.
Okay. I am the world's most ineffectual technician when it comes to photography. I've struggled from day one with, you know, I look at objects. If they've been put together, I can't tell how they're going to, even if it's really simple. But with these nice lenses that I've got, they flatten everything out. There's no distortion. No chromatic aberration. They have this lovely flattening effect because we've got, and I work with a very wide open aperture, so I have a tiny sliver through the dimension. If you imagine, you know, the space that this is situated in when I photograph it, I might have a little tiny bit this deep right through that might be in focus. So what I did is I just got, because it is so bright anyway, because it's collecting light and reflecting it within itself and reflecting off it, you actually don't need very much light to do this. So it's on a black background. And I just used so I've got a Canon Mark II D5, it's quite a beautiful camera, and I just used an off-camera flash, like the one that usually just put in with the hot shoe. I just took it off to the side and held it up. And on the other side, I had a big silver reflector just propped up against the table. So I can promise you it wasn't that difficult to do. Photography's made out to be a lot more kind of elaborate than it needs to be a lot of the time. So if I can do it, I reckon anybody can.